Go. Hello, foreign entanglements viewers. My name, as always, is Dr. Rob Farley of the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce at the University of Kentucky. And with me today is Kelsey Atherton. How are you doing today, Kelsey?
I'm doing all right. I'm Kelsey Atherton. I'm with Popular Science. I cover defense and national security issues for them.
Groovy. And this is your first blogging heads, first time you've been here?
This is my first time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Then it's everybody's first time having seen you, except for your close friends, who, I will be honest, probably make up like 40% of the audience. What we're going to talk about today, we're going to talk about two distinct, but you know, I wouldn't say that they're completely distinct because I'm sure we'll figure out a way to relate them. The first thing we're going to talk about is drones and misconceptions about drones. And the second thing we're going to talk about is Ender's Game, which neither of us have seen, but both of us have done a substantial amount of reading in the universe. Should be an interesting conversation. I think we probably could sort through some connections between those two. So anyway, but to start off with drones and misconceptions about drones, so what are you working on right now with respect to drones?
Well, I just got back this morning. The World Wildlife Fund had a symposium on technology and anti-poaching, and I, as I related a few times there, I stumbled into writing about anti-poaching because I was writing about other uses of drones. Mm-hmm. And the ones everyone knows is that, like, they carry missiles and they kill people. And while that's definitely a thing that they do, that's a very, very tiny part of what unmanned machines do. Mm-hmm. And the poaching stuff is a lot of – they've been used a little bit so far. It's working at more. Will they be used more in the future? But when they're used in anti-poaching, they fly over fly over game preserves in the Congo or elsewhere, Tanzania. Kenya actually used them with an army sweep, but they'll fly over and they'll watch. They'll be able to track poachers, detect poachers, and then hopefully direct rangers there to intercept them. And that's a wholly different use than the killer robots over Pakistan we're used to.
Right, it's a wholly different use, but the principle's the same, right? I mean, that you have long loiter capability, you have reconnaissance capability, and you have you don't have to pay for the expense of having a pilot. So really, except for the Hellfire missile or except for the bomb that a Reaper might drop, what you're looking at here is really sort of using the same characteristics of drones, the same characteristics that are used to hunt Taliban in Pakistan and so forth.
Well, sort of. Ideally, I mean, if were money no object in anti-poaching, they would love to use Predators and Reapers and Global Hawks because those are the absolute best at the long endurance and the flying. Mm-hmm. The problem is that budgets are really tight, and even the cheaper commercial drones that are usually on the market for stuff like this, like the Ariane Scout or the Dragonflyer, which like are quad rotors, or a Dragonflyer is technically a hexarotor, but they fly for about an hour and a half on the battery charge, and they're simple to pilot things, but those cost like $50,000 to $60,000 before $50,000 to $60,000 before you put any sensors on them. So that is still prohibitive. We were looking at one, they had one in the audience today of someone brought the Falcon UAV guys had one there, and that one costs $15,000, and that's like the cheaper thing. So the loiter isn't so much what you're getting out of this. What you are getting, though, they had a video of the Falcon flying, and there's not a lot of great places to land in the African bush. It's very tricky. You would not want to be a pilot tasked with landing something there. You all right there, Mr. Wall? So what they showed in the video is that the way the Falcon lands is it's light and it's pretty – the materials are pretty self-flexible. They can handle landing, but they pop a parachute out, and it just
crashes into it. Pardon me.
And that's what does it.
So what you're really looking for is flexibility in terms of where it comes down?
Well, that was where it comes down and how easy it is to launch. This thing is launched by a bungee cord. Like, they do a bungee pull, basically like a slingshot, get it up in the air, and then they fly around and they can see it, and it's recording the whole time. So what they get is it's cheaper. This is not so much long endurance, but this is a lot cheaper than flying any other manned aircraft, and you can land it easier.
Right, so cheaper than sort of an older helicopter, cheaper than, you know, a Piper Caribou or something like that you would be sending up. And presumably the piloting skills are less
With the Falcon specifically, mm-hmm. not to be all PR for them, but with the Falcon specifically, it flies a pre-programmed route, and then you have it on a laptop, and you can, like, click somewhere else if you want it to go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And so you steer it. You can modify a preset course in flight, but it's doing all the complicated task of flying itself, and then you hit a button to deploy the parachute and land it.
Right. And then, of course, you have to have somebody to go and track it down, right?
So you don't track it. You have to have something to do once you get all the data and stuff, but it's a very...
Mm-hmm. Does it download immediately, or do you have to, like, get a tape out of it?
It streams, but you get high. You can download higher resolution later, mm-hmm. I believe. There was actually a really cool thing in Boulder in the flooding, mm-hmm. where Falcon, they're based in Denver, they went up and they... No one was flying for a few days, so they went up and they plotted out the flooding over a couple of rivers, mm-hmm. Or over a river and over on Google Maps and had a map that rescue workers could use for a little while.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So is this something – so you hear about and so part of the point of using these specifically anti-poaching operations is that you're able to track down perpetrators, right? But there's also theoretically a deterrence effect, right, that you're able to stop people who people who are worried about one of these UAVs. So, I mean, are these visible? I mean, can people see them around? Is this something that if I were about to shoot an elephant, I might see and know?
We're in the incredibly early stages of this. I think mm-hmm. There's a project launching in early 2014 to do a lot more mapping and tracking on this. Mm-hmm. They mentioned one small part of one park where they managed to like track two groups of rhinos and then provide information over it. But we're at the very new stage of it. And there's the trick, Triff. They want to have the deterrent factor of a flying thing that scares people away, mm-hmm. or do they want to make sure the observation goes unnoticed so that they can catch people in the act and then trace it back? Mm-hmm. There was a lot. It was really like largely law enforcement kind of feel to it of figuring out what people in the chain you want to catch mm-hmm. and what role do drones have in it. And they have some potentially. Mm-hmm. Which is really interesting. But the other, like broadly, the other great misperception of drones, and this is what they will be doing in Africa when they're fighting poaching, is that drones are scouts. Drones are flying eyeballs 90% of the time, more than that. Mm-hmm. What they do is they watch large areas, or they watch areas for a long time, especially the military ones, they watch for a long time. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, like the targeted killing program is a subset of a subset of what they do. There's combat support that they will sometimes have, or they might just be that that Marines patrolling in Afghanistan have an eyeballs flying above them, and they can get feedback on where other things are because someone's looking back at the monitor mm-hmm. and can say, "Oh yeah, they're over that hill."
Right.
And that's really like a lot of what drones do instead.
Now here's a sort of a follow-up question to that, which is how much, you know, I mean, to what extent, you know, because, and I'm sure you're aware, and I've also seen lots of stories about the use of drones in disaster relief, about the use of drones in other sorts of, policing affairs, obviously, but how much has sort of what is growing into a popular perception of what drones do, is that deterring organizations like the WWF or like any other organization from thinking about the utility of drones, right? Is there anybody out there saying, no, I don't want to use a drone because it's bad for my organization for it to be perceived that we're doing this sort of thing?
I think they're very careful. Drone is the common term. Drone is what we use. I work in media. Drone is what people understand. And then I like clarify later, but they're very careful in formal things to talk about unmanned vehicles, mm-hmm. Because that's still the vogue term. The AUVSI, the mm-hmm. great drone industry organization and lobby, mm-hmm. Is very big on it. When they had a press conference, when they had a big conference, the Wi-Fi password for the press room. Don't say drones. So there's a fear of the word, but an organization like the World Wildlife Fund comes to it knowing that this technology itself has the potential to be really useful, and it's very clearly not an armed thing that they're doing. We're not mm-hmm. going to be firing hellfires to stop people trying to get elephants. Conservationists aren't the kind to do that. So they bring their clout to it, mm-hmm. and I think they're able to use their clout to destigmatize the machine somewhat.
Right. Well, I mean, okay. At the same time, I can see. I don't doubt that. The pointy end of the state, the violent end of the state, gets involved in anti-poaching operations. Right. I'm sure poachers get shot now and again doing things which violate state law. Right. And so this is conservation organizations thinking about these terms. Right. But is someday some government that's really frustrated with anti-poaching problems going to say, well, you know, heck. And of course, they can't afford a predator anyway. So I guess maybe it's an absurd question, right? I'm sorry, go ahead.
So this is actually really interesting. It's one of the – what the international community is trying to do, at least what I saw at the conference today and what I've seen before, mm-hmm. Is they're trying to bring it around to a very law enforcement approach where sometimes poachers are going to get shot, but they want it to be more like sometimes police officers shoot people than they want it to be like soldiers do. Because right now, when the big anti-poaching works, in the spring, Kenya had a big anti-poaching drive, which meant they mobilized their army to go and sweep and protect the area and clear. But that's not – they can't do that always, and that's not the approach you want. What you want to do is catch the poachers and then trace it up the supply chain.
Right.
And really get the people who are actually, like, supplying them with the weapons and buying it off of them. That's where you want to be catching things, and it's hard to do that when you do a shoot-first approach.
Right. And so in this sense, it's actually the exact opposite of the drone campaign as it's conventionally understood in Yemen and Pakistan, where we are specific, or we're at least supposed to be, you know, signature strikes being a little bit different, right? But we're supposed to be specifically targeting critical members of the organizations we're talking about, critical members of Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda associated. But in this case, shooting the poachers is counterproductive, right? Because they are just, you know, poor people there hunting elephants and so forth, and it tells you nothing about the organization and doesn't destructure the organization at all.
Absolutely. One of the Richardson Center was there, my former governor, Bill Richardson, is
are you blogging heading today from New Mexico, or are you?
I am not. I'm doing my best impression here. But
oh, okay. Yeah.
He was in DC. DC for this. But one of the things that the Richardson Center is doing in anti-poaching is a poachers to rangers program, which we think of like how you would like. It sounds crazy, or it's super skeptical when we're like dealing with like Afghanistan to say we're going to turn Taliban into ANA. That's problems. That's lots and lots of problems. But when you're turning poachers into it, into rangers, they have the knowledge and a steadier paycheck, which in a lot of ways comes through some foreign support.
Right,
is a better option.
Right. You're not expecting people, or at least very many people, to be ideologically committed to poaching. Right.
Right.
You know, in the United States, of course, you have a huge hunting is a huge hobby. We're not talking about that sort of thing here. So how much of the UAV industry? I mean, you're kind of an industry watcher here. Like, is the military part of the UAV, and you know, specifically unmanned aerial vehicle, is the military part like really a small, tiny corner of this, or is there a lot of money flowing in to the military part that then kind of subsidizes all this? Right. I mean, so which way does the money flow here?
The money flows military, but in the U.S. it flows military. There are other places where there's potential for it to flow out other ways. The big problem is, and as obviously depending on it's the biggest and the shiniest, and they have the budget for it, and they have the long, persistent surveillance needs. And it's military, and when other agencies, like when Customs and Border Patrol needs predators, they get hand-me-downs from Afghanistan, or from our use in Afghanistan. So that's where a lot of the money is, but that's the same big manufacturers we have for everything, really. Like, that's you're going to have your Boeings, your General Dynamics, your General Atomics, you're going to have your Northrop Grumman's. They're always going to have some of that. There's a whole other market that is a lot of smaller things, and there's some military overlap there with commercial. And what's really like going to make that whole market take off is when the FAA figures out how we're going to let commercial drones fly in the U.S. Because right. other countries have that. Other countries, you can do filming by drone, or you can do – and drone delivery is the thing that's touted and maybe not cost-effective, but you can do other commercial activity with drones.
I mean, drone delivery doesn't even necessarily work on a military. I mean, like, you have the K-PAX drone helicopter that – I think it's the K-PAX. Anyway.
Yeah, it's K-MAX.
Yeah, K-MAX. Which is really kind of cost prohibitive. But anyway, go ahead.
No, but the K-MAX is a great example of it because mm-hmm. the military has a very specific need to deliver in straight lines through continuous shifts by helicopter mm-hmm. the supplies that the K-MAX was delivering. It delivered mm-hmm. like some million tons of – like 5 million tons, I think, mm-hmm. something like that. More the numbers, whatever. But a tremendous amount for that. However mm-hmm. – you could do it for far less by 18-wheelers if you had roads.
Right.
If you had roads that were safe. And so the military has a need where that would be – where they can afford to spend money on it, where other people just – it would just – the deliveries wouldn't happen if 18-wheelers were your option. 18-wheelers are far more economical for a lot of it.
Right.
So we'll see – so delivery is a weird thing for the drones to be competing on, but what they can do really well is they should be competing with like crop dusting eventually, but helicopters and aerial photography is the easiest market to open it up. Mm-hmm. There was something in the Russia Valley, California. There was a vineyard that paired with a drone company, and they just flew the drone over the vineyard. They were able to see with a whole perspective that you get like that mm-hmm. the top of the hill had darker vines and this crescent at the bottom of the hill had darker vines. Mm-hmm. And so that meant you had two grapes growing similarly that you wouldn't have been able to catch on the ground easy. And it would take a helicopter. Like that would just be, it would be more expensive to do a helicopter than fly a drone out and catch it.
Right. And so, you know, in terms of civilian organizations, we would also be thinking about drones being able to fill, play a role for like traffic copters and so forth, right?
For traffic copters, like, mm-hmm. I mean, people hate red light cams and they're going to mm-hmm. really hate red light drones.
right. Right. And it's a state capacity issue, right? I mean, and there is sort of a legitimate state capacity issue there, right? That you're increasing state surveillance, but.
Absolutely. The big issue that is, I mean, I'd say there are official channels to deal with state surveillance, but mm-hmm. the NSA thing makes it all super shaky. But the other big worry is that what happens when paparazzi get them?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because you get paparazzi or you get like private investigators with them and then you get weird boundaries. Where does – right now the laws there's a case, I think it was Riley v. Florida. Mm-hmm. Where a police helicopter was just flying over and they saw someone growing marijuana in their like backyard. Mm-hmm. And the ruling was that it was flying at 400 feet and you didn't have an expectation of privacy from 400 feet down. Mm-hmm. If you can see it that easily, it was determined that. And so what happens if we just – do we lose the privacy of above a certain level, a certain height?
Right, I mean, that's interesting because you start thinking about property values in terms of the airspace above the property, right, which has traditionally been sort of a state sovereignty issue. But this is do I have the right to deny a not just a state-oriented but a privately owned drone from the airspace above my house, right, or the airspace above the university or something like that?
There was a weird case in Texas where a guy was doing aerial photography just mm-hmm. personally, and he found a slaughterhouse that had been dumping dumping its runoff into a river. Mm-hmm. And the trial went through, he presented this as evidence. He's like, look at this. He wasn't like looking for it, but he mm-hmm. found it. It was admitted in the slaughterhouse was in trouble, but Texas immediately passed a law banning private photography from remote control vehicles.
Of course, Texas being Texas, but.
But yeah, but it's really weird that they immediately looked at that, which was like a genuine mm-hmm. public good was found this way, mm-hmm. and they're like, we need to clamp down on privacy. We need to protect privacy here.
Right.
So it's weird, and we're going to have a weird commercial thing, and I mentioned all the complications because I'm generally pro the technology, but I was mm-hmm. at a drones and aerial robotics conference in New York mm-hmm. a few weeks ago. And there was a panel about the broader implications, and this was entirely focused on domestic commercial uses mm-hmm. and like hobbyist stuff. And there was a panel that tried to tie the existence of like quadrotors flying over farms to mm-hmm. look at different levels of crops, different coloration in crops, mm-hmm. to the targeted killing program in Pakistan. And we're not going to have any real substantive conversation about those privacy issues or what to deal with when private people are flying cameras everywhere mm-hmm. back home if we can't get past the fact that the category is broad and we don't need to mention the targeted killing program every time.
Right. Every time we think about a civilian helicopter or a police helicopter, we don't talk about an Apache, AH-64, right? Yeah.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. It would be as if – and there was a call to say that you have to actively – that drone manufacturers, in order to be moral – and this was a very clearly a far-left ideological stance, but mm-hmm. To be moral, they have to actively disassociate from the technology and the category that is the military one. And that would be like if you – when you were buying a car, the dealer had to tell you that the car manufacturer had never made like a – like M1 Abrams exist, therefore you can't buy cars was a line of thought being argued, and that's right. Supremely unhelpful.
Right. Now, is there any feedback that goes the other direction, right? Is there anything happening in sort of this developing civilian market that you can look forward and say, wow, this is something we can really envision military applications for that we haven't already?
It's hard to say because the military is pretty good at figuring out how to quickly get cameras overhead.
But there's
a lot more similarity in the market. What I talk about with like quadrotors, mm-hmm. like the quadrotors, the very basic, simple ones, mm-hmm. the military does with Ravens, which are the most numerous drone we have. They're 4 pounds, hand tossed. They look over the next hill and they tell the guy piloting it right there what's over the next hill, and then they break apart like Legos when they land and you put it back together.
Right.
When you get it, or if you lose it, it's not the most expensive piece of military equipment. So there's a lot of overlap in the small drone category, but there's mm-hmm. really, there's not a lot of applications that are coming from commercial that would be military. There's one other texture though that's really, people talk about how the military has been like, driving, and the military has been using drones for a while, and they've been making strides with them. Mm-hmm. But the other big driver of drones, and especially small drones, is improved cell phone technology.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's
because what you're going to get is you get better sensors, you get better accelerometers. Mm-hmm. The phone I carry in my pocket, accelerometer, GPS, a small portable camera. It's not a great camera, but it's a serviceable camera. It doesn't stream, but others could. Mm-hmm. And it has it transmits a signal, and it has a battery designed to be small and last a long time while powering a complex series of electronics.
Right.
The developments there, which shrink and cheapen this technology, are really a lot, I think, of what's making drones work and what's going to make commercial drones work better.
Right.
And that's in market entirely developed, not even in parallel. That's just outside of the military drone development. Military might spur better infrared cameras mm-hmm. and better high altitude or medium altitude long endurance. They might get the bigger things. They spur that because they're the niche market for that.
Right.
But there's a broader market for smaller portable sensors that transmit signals easily mm-hmm. that rely on battery power, and cell phones are really the biggest game there that I think drones are going to be picking up from or have been.
Right. And so there's potential for happy coincidence between those technologies, right? Or happy collaboration, collusion. Synergy. It's weird. Synergy is a weird word because it's a buzzword and it's one that you should reject, but it actually does make sense.
That's an actually appropriate use of it.
Right. So sort of away from this flying robots of death and to a sort of more fanciful topic, you and I are both fans of this novel/series of novels, Ender's Game, which by the time we're recording this on Halloween, which of course is why I'm dressed as a meth dealer.
And his helpful assistant. Come on.
And your helpful assistant. Right. That's why we're both dressed as meth dealers and meth cooks, right? Meth kingpins? Anyway. So, away from that to Ender's Game, right? And so, we are looking tomorrow at Ender's Game coming out, which is a moment that I've been anticipating since the mid-1980s. And I know a lot of people have been anticipating. You've read 5 of the novels. I've read 3 of the novels. I guess starting off, what are your thoughts about sort of about the series, about what the series means? Why is it interesting, important to you? And what are your great terrors with respect to this movie?
Well, the series itself, there's another post coming out on Grand Blog Tarkin about it tomorrow. Hopefully I haven't had it, but it's, we had one earlier actually about it as Maneuver Warfare, but the series itself is just a look at Total War and Total War as a game pursued ruthlessly by people who have not had, there's no rigid doctrinaire in there anyway. When you select children to figure out how to fight wars, you're looking for unconventional thinking. You're looking for interesting things, and it's really fascinating to see what that is and what they mean. One of the later series of, one of the later books in the parallel series, Ender's Shadows, follows one of the characters from Ender, and then Shadow of the Hegemon follows it, and they like war, a world war fought by these child generals, looks at just what the implications are suddenly when you put political power on it. But Ender's Game is just abstractly like tactics, or not tactics, but strategy, tactics a bit, as fought by people who learned it as play.
Right.
Just fascinating.
Right, right. There is no doubt something really sort of genuine. I mean, so this appreciation of the flexible intellect of child, and really there's an entire system in the novels of detecting sort of intellectual and military talent that children have. But at the same time, and I remember having this conversation, I'm not sure exactly who with, but I remember that an argument for this appeal actually stems, you know, in very substantial part from even the opening scenes of the novel where, spoiler alert, our hero sort of literally beats to death another child, right? That our hero here, who is a sort of, I don't want to call him nerdlinger or anything like that, right? But he's an intellectual kid, he is tormented by other children, and he literally, and you don't find this out until later, right? But he literally beats to death one of his tormentors, right? And so the novel sort of, on a psychological basis, fills that fantastic need that a lot of the readers are going to be able to identify with Ender so quickly, and identify it with his talent. And that's what makes it such a compelling series, right? In addition to, so the really interesting sort of world building that that card undertakes, but I guess I'm curious to see how much of that. I mean, it's just harder to identify in that way with characters on the screen than it is on the page, I guess. So I don't know. But do you have any thoughts?
It's going to be tricky to identify with that. It's going to be, it's hard imagining the person for whom Ender's Game isn't already spoiled, but that tension over finding out about the death of his tormentor long after it happens.
Right.
And like making that a meaningful revelation, because you're pulled in and you identify with this kid who's like this. When it's describing the fight of the kid, it very intellectualizes the violence, like how he like places his weight and understands the force of his tormentor and like where they're coming and how he's attacking and how he balances and does that, so you get a very intellectual approach.
It actually reminds me a lot. I hadn't thought about this before you mentioned it, but it reminds me a lot of how the fighting is, represented in the otherwise sort of excoriable Robert Downey Jr.'s Sherlock Holmes movies, right? Right, where it's highly intellectualized, where he's thinking about all those things as he's fighting, right?
No, absolutely, absolutely, and that makes it so that you have, because in the first one, he's a kindergartner.
Right.
Who does all of this, you have him thinking about it, and you identify with the thinking and the cleverness, and then you divorce the consequences of violence from it. You know he wins a fight, and then later on you find out at what cost.
Right.
Which is perhaps a running theme with the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And to make that have the same weight in the film, I think it happened, there are at least three instances that I recall in the book where you have that same kind of tension.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be very interesting to see if they can pull off that emotional weight, or if they'll just do it in a, like, look at this kid, he's a badass.
Right.
And then look how badass he is as he badasses his way through the thing.
Right. Right, right, right. Whether they do it in that sort of linear way that sort of rather than going back and complicating the character's previous actions. What do you think? I mean, do you have any particular thoughts about sort of the broader controversy over? I mean, because I know this is, you know, a lot of people are talking about this right now, but the broader thoughts with respect to the controversy over Card himself.
The best thing I've found with regard to that controversy.
Alyssa Rosenberg has written quite a bit about this.
Absolutely. Yeah. How do you deal with culturally significant works from like awful people? Because Scott Card is a tremendous homophobe and says vile things, and
right.
yet wrote a book that's really like strong, compelling characters and a very compelling story, and is culturally significant. It's assigned reading everywhere. It really captures it. It poses some great questions.
Mm-hmm.
I just read Alyssa's piece. Really is my biggest delve into it. There's nothing I could say about it that she didn't say better.
Right, right, right. And I suspect that she'll probably do some sort of blogging heads about the film, because I think she's already had the opportunity to see it. What do you think about, and this is sort of the drawback to the connection with drones, what do you think about the sort of the depiction of networked warfare in Ender's Game, right? And sort of thinking about that in context of sort of the way that what we call networked warfare has developed in modern context. I mean, you know, this issue of connectivity and so forth really comes through in right. I mean, sort of their instantaneous connection with these battles very far away, to the point where they can control and give orders and everything else.
Right. But there's.
And I don't remember. And here's the other thing, but to interrupt you before you even get started, I don't remember thinking about the idea of general officers, which is fundamentally what these children are, really controlling a battle from a remote space. I didn't think about. There was no way for me to think about it except in context of this novel, right? That this novel sort of structures the way that I think about that.
Well, it's interesting because about the same time, like I was a kid reading it, I was playing a lot of real-time strategy games, which you take on the role of a like omniscient god general, where you instantaneously issue commands to units that follow very simple orders.
Right.
And you maneuver around things, and the kids too are introduced to this as a game, where they think that is what is happening, and they are actually the biggest spoiler of spoiler warnings, they are actually fighting a war. That's what Ender's Game is. It's actually a war. But they're taught it as a training exercise for a war. They're taught it as a game. And instantaneous, there's other computer games show up in Ender's Game where instantaneous command is fine and where it interacts with you. And you just expect it to follow orders exactly. And that's what's so... What's interesting then is I don't know... This might be, let me phrase it like this. I think if Card were to rewrite Ender's Game, or if Ender's Game were to be written now, there wouldn't be people on the ships.
Right, right.
You wouldn't have, it would be entirely remote war. You would send out your fleets of ships that have, they have the Ansible as the communicator that instantly connects. You would have your Ansible that instantly connects, and you would spread commands through there. So you didn't have to worry about sending soldiers a long time and hoping they obey. Because
right. I mean, you might even send some percentage of maintenance techs and everything else with leaders and everything else to make sure the ship still functioned when they arrived. Right.
Right. But you definitely don't need it to be like.
You don't need fighter pilots.
You don't need fighter pilots. You don't need battleships. You don't need the full crew. What they are is they're, because they all use the same weapon too. These are just gigantic delivery systems for a special, for a powerful gun.
Right.
Basically. Right. It's actually really interesting to look at it as the bridge I was thinking between this and drones is a misperception of drones is that it's video game warfare. And Ender's Game, it fully explores what happens when you think you're playing a video game and you realize the consequences of fighting a war. And drone pilots get that real quick because they're viewing Ender has to wait till the war is over to find out the consequences of his actions and realize that it was a war. Drone pilots get that feedback instantly.
Right, right, right.
Which is one of those things where it's, you are distant from the war, but you are still commanding violence. And that still has psychological weight and import. And it's clearly, obviously, far better to be the person sitting in the remote seat than be the person on the receiving end of the attack. But it's not without consequence to be in that remote seat.
Right. Now, I think, to my recollection, in Ender's Shadow, they do sort of develop a little bit more distance, right? Where it does sort of feel at times as if the pilots in these ships that are being controlled by the children are actually obeying orders, right? Rather than they are actually conducting the flying themselves rather than being directly controlled, which is, you know, perhaps, you know, Card sort of saw where we were going in terms of the technology and sort of had to, you know, had to introduce some sort of break, right? Although, here's the other thing, right? And I hadn't thought about these terms before. The aliens in this have their own wireless, right?
Yes.
They have sort of just, it's built-in wireless, right? And so they have immediate connectivity with one another. And they also have this hive mind system where they have a central controller.
Right. No, they are quite literally drones.
Right. 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 No, they're literally, no, I hadn't thought about that. They are literally drones except for, you know,
except for the queen.
Right. Except for the queen. So, yeah.
So, yeah, no, you get two civilizations fighting hive warfare where there are people on the ships in, there are people on the ships in Ender's Game. There's, so it's still, it's humans doing it, but they're operating as though it's two minds fighting with a whole array of mechanical parts.
Right.
Basically. Ender has his subcoordinates. There's some autonomy allowed in there, but you're really getting the kind of weird singular control points that war doesn't really have. Like, I'm sure Stalin and Hitler, like when they were commanding the, I'm trying to remember what this was. I think it was St. Peter. I think it was the Battle of Leningrad, where they were respectively in charge and like actually giving orders. They felt like they were directly commanding all of this, but there was so much less clear immediate communication and lots of other layers intermediaries that it's not exactly that. We're getting...
Both of them were very frustrated about their ability to control things that were actually going on the ground. Right.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the queens control things perfectly.
Mm-hmm. Right, or virtually perfectly, yeah.
Or virtually perfectly, as you get.
Right. Oh, that's fascinating. That's a fascinating thought. Right, and we're not... You know, we're not. We have this vision of networked warfare, but we're not. there's pushback against it. There's pushback against it that's non-technological, but there's also, or that's technological, and there's pushback against it that's non-technological, right? Right. Specific argument that this is just a terrible way of envisioning war, right? And envisioning trying to fight a war. But there's no, nobody ever makes Ender or anyone else pay for this vision of warfare, I don't think, in the series of novels.
Right. His...
His penance is genocide. Genocide is what he's afflicted with.
Genocide, yeah.
Yeah.
The consequences that Ender experiences are never... they're never strategic or tactical. There's personal consequences. He gets a lot of moral guilt. The war is viewed as a total war.
Mm-hmm.
When he... Shadow of the Hegemon, which delves into the war after the war when Earth realizes they don't have a common enemy anymore, and they have a ton of military genius children of various nationalities, and they break into a world war of sorts, is really interesting exploring that. But Ender himself doesn't – his strategic vision is never wrong in this. He gets better and better at the strategy as the thing goes on, and there isn't – the alien species, the buggers, don't adapt to it.
Right.
They're tactical adaptations. They spread out.
Right.
They learn that the weapon works on dense targets, so they spread out, and you have to maneuver around that and figure that out. But that's there's a tactical innovation, but there's no strategic one. They don't figure out how to counter the fleet.
Right.
There's no strategic. I'm sure in the battle school bit there's some defeats, but it takes a lot.
Right. Right. It's actually never clear, right? Which doesn't make any sense if you think about it, right? I mean, these are fleets which have been deployed 25 years in the past, and they just always happen to end up in the right place with enough force to, win the specific battle that they're fighting. Right. And that part is not Ender, right? That part is actually, the battle school just sort of sorting through. And I guess it happens to have a killer weapon that the other side really can't deal with. But
right. It's also – but it's interesting, too. There is one part where it looks like he's just going to be out – they're outnumbered and they're outswarmed. Mm-hmm. That's the – and this is spoilers all over, but this is the great concluding battle where it looks like they're going to be – shot down, there's just too many enemies to fight their way through, and he realizes he doesn't need to be fighting the fleet, he fights the planet, and that's foreshadowed by a battle in the training part of battle school. It's like the floating around zero gravity, three-dimensional, basically laser tag, which had a ceremonial ending to the game that is actually the victory condition.
Right.
And he realizes that you can just achieve the victory condition and ignore enemy forces on your way to do so.
Which is so John Warden.
Right, no, it's a very... I mean, it's victory ex machina, but it's... Yeah, it's that's the trick of maneuver warfare, right? Is that you can ignore the forces and hit what actually matters.
Right, right, right.
And they're trying to explore that idea, and they do. But the idea, there isn't... I just can't recall a defeat Ender faces that he learns from and changes after.
Right. 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 Now, he learns from some of his victories, right? But that's all he ever learns from, right? He never learns from a defeat.
Right. And there's... And so it's a weirdly... And it's focused so much on strategy, but it's... And I keep comparing it to the video games I've played in the real-time strategy games, where you fight the AI, and once you figure out how the AI response works, there will be harder missions, but you will beat them because you know the limitations of the opponent.
Right. Right.
And it can't, and it doesn't and can't adapt.
Right.
Which just is a profoundly limited way to look at things, because the fundamental rule is that the other side adapts.
Right. Right. So when are you going to see it? Do you have a plan?
Not sure. There might be a plan to see it tomorrow. We'll see.
Yeah, no, I don't think I'm
sneaking
I don't think
away with some think progress types.
I don't think we're going to be able to see it this weekend. There's always this threat that the reviews will be terrible and I won't want to see it, right? Which is scary for me, right? Because it's such an important sort of touchstone in my
I felt the same way when Watchmen came out.
Right. Well, I watched Watchmen, right? It wasn't that, it was fine. It was an exact copy, right? If you're Yeah. Exactly. So, yeah. Anyway. All right. Well, what was that?
Yeah, we'll see.
All right.
Should be good.
All right, well, groovy. Well, then, foreign and tankless viewers, we thank you for watching our show on drones and on Ender's Game and on video warfare. From Lexington, Kentucky, I bid you adieu. And Kelsey?
From Washington, D.C.
Or should I say Jesse?
Yeah. Sure thing, Mr. White.
All right. We will hopefully see you soon.
Absolutely. Bye.